You may be seated.
Our third case is in re application of Michelle McKinney. For the applicant is Mr. Richards.
Mr. Richards here. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the applicant to ask that she be allowed to reapply for the bar exam. I'd like to talk about her recent few years and ask the court if I could reserve my remaining time for rebuttal and closing. In the recent years, she's very settled and stable now. She's married with two children, exemplary law school student. We see letters from professors, pages 3, 9, 18, and 19 of the transcript, and a letter from a Butler County magistrate, all recommending Michelle. She does charity work in her free time. She was appointed by the law school faculty in 2008 as president of the Student Advocacy Society. She was then hired by the law school in 2009 as director of the Center for Excellence in Advocacy. She's expressed great remorse for her poor judgment. That's in the Cincinnati Review Board report. She understands that a lawyer must have integrity, honesty, and resist temptation. She's exhibited continuous employment now for almost the past 4 years with the same law firm. She's been promoted to a position of trust. She handles checks, deposits, money, and deals with supervising other staff members for the firm and deals with judges, attorneys, magistrates, and clients on a daily basis. This has all occurred since the incident back in 2008 with the former employer. On the bar application issue, we agree, and she understands, looking back, she should have included the letterhead incident as part of the reason for termination. She admits she could have been more thorough. That's page 63 of the
transcript. Well, don't you mean more truthful?
I'm sorry?
Don't you mean more truthful, not thorough?
I think she could have been both. I agree, Your Honor. She relied mistakenly, however, on her own memory, which I think is part of the problem here, without requesting her employment file prior to filling out the application.
Kind of time lapse had occurred between her discharge and the filling out the application?
March 2008 was the termination. The application process was in the fall of 2010, so it was about 2.5 years. I think going back to the interview process and the application process, in December of 2010, she was at her 24th week and her first pregnancy. It had become a very medically difficult pregnancy for her and the child. In fact, the doctors were worried that the child may not make it. She went through that interview anyway in December because she had registered for the February bar exam. We get to the next month in January of 2011. The board granted her a review process on January 26th. Unfortunately, 11 days prior to the review board, she gave birth to a premature 28-week-old child. They were both checked into ICU immediately, and mother and child stayed in ICU for over 30 days. But 11 days into the birth, that's when she had her board review, and she was certainly not 100% ready for that either. She was certainly distracted thinking about her child, 11 days old, back in the ICU. I think she was physically drained from that birth.
And this was when?
This was in January of 2011, which was the Cincinnati full board review of the interviewer's recommendation. She should have also had counsel at that meeting, did not. She didn't have time, obviously, in ICU to review her file, and she should have postponed the meeting. It was a mistake, but there have been a lot of mistakes made.
There was a June 30th hearing also, was there not?
Then there was the panel hearing here in this building.
Yes.
And June 30th, right, approximately 5 months later after the Cincinnati board review.
And were there problems then as well? Because they were not impressed with her candor, is the kindest way one could put it, at that June 30th hearing. So
I agree with you.
Can look back on the conduct involving the apartment and all of that as a bad mistake, but now she's having to deal with the repercussions of all of that. And she's here in Columbus, and the right to take the exam is in jeopardy, and the board is not impressed with her candor at that point. Can you help us with that?
Yeah, I think, well, one thing, she was pregnant again. And as it turned out, she was going through some medications. I think that in both instances, the interview process, the board review in Cincinnati, and again up here, it was her second pregnancy. Again, a 27-week-old premature child was born in December, a few months after that board meeting. So she's had some medical issues. She's had a lot of medication.
Did she have counsel at that hearing?
Yes, she did. Mr. Johnson represented her at that panel hearing. I think she got very frazzled over the whole process and struggling to remember exactly what happened. And by two times with the interviewers and the board both turning her down, I think by the time she got here, she was just desperately trying to figure out, get her memory together and give a full story. I think it just got confusing for her. She did stop herself in her defense from sending those letters. Those never got used. They never got printed on a piece of paper. They were strictly a digital image that was a fleeting moment. I think she scrapped the idea as fast as she got the idea. And that morning, before the emails were discovered, she had already determined it was a bad idea and was not going to go through with it. So we find some of that testimony at pages 58, 91, and 92 of the transcript. I do think, again, if we look back at the confusion over the termination, and Ms. Ferris, who testified for the employer, agreed, she concurred in all of this, that only emails were shown to Michelle at the termination meeting. Only emails. That's page 47 of the transcript. There were no letters shown to her at all at that termination meeting. Odd if that's why they were terminating her, but it didn't show her any. It was very brief, few words spoken. Only a Ms. Miller spoke. Ms. Ferris did not. She admits that. And Ms. Miller never testified or appeared in any of these proceedings. So I think we have too much focus on emails at that termination meeting. It's in the record. And I think another point
Council,
that confirmed.
I'm sorry to interrupt, sure. But, you know, I was just looking at the notes I read when I was reading over the record here in this case. And I can accept that she didn't know when she had the first meeting with regard to her termination, but it appeared that during those subsequent meetings she continued to say that she wasn't fired for that and that she minimized. And then going into a full board hearing 11 days after having a child who's got some serious health issues, she didn't request a continuance. I mean, all through my mind I kept noting there are judgment questions for me because clearly the board would have given her an extension since she just had a baby, and why she failed to not immediately upon being notified after the first hearing take responsibility.
I think she considered the postponement, but she had paid for and applied for the February exam, and she knew if she was going to get through this process, it had to be then. And of course, she didn't want to leave her baby, but she did, an 11-day-old child wired to machines in ICU, but she went to that board meeting. She shouldn't if it was a bad decision, but she did it. And now we're having to live with it. And I think what led her to put down the email was not so much dishonesty. I think it was naivety. I think it was innocence. I think it was a misunderstanding of this process. You know, law school doesn't really teach these kids how to come out and go through the application process. They're used to doing applications for jobs. And what do you do on a job application? You put your best foot out there. You don't put all the bad stuff down. And I really just think these kids aren't educated in this process. I think she was naive. That's all I can really say about that. But I think on the Cincinnati board review also, she was naive to go into that without counsel and very naive to go into that unprepared, had not looked at the file, and had just given birth to that child. Now, I agree with you, Your Honor.
What is she doing now?
She's still with the law firm of almost 4 years. She's a supervisor. She's in a management position and supervises the whole staff and deals with judges, lawyers on a daily basis.
And that law firm is what?
Richards and Associates.
Located?
Cincinnati.
Right.
And so she's very stable now.
How many employees is she supervising?
There are four. All law school students. All the employees there are law school students, either graduates or in some level of law school. And she supervises all those people.
And what's the nature of their practice?
Civil, transactional civil, banking, that type, some little domestic, but mostly transactional trust work, corporations, partnerships, real estate. There's a title agency there, and she's involved in all of that.
Collections?
Yes. Yes. We back to the meeting. I think she was left with the impression that day, and admittedly by Ms. Ferris, that there was all focus on emails and no focus on letterhead. Didn't even show her letterhead when she got to the meeting. It was brief, few words spoken, and as we said, the person who spoke didn't even appear at any of these proceedings. And so we're not really sure exactly what was said, but we know in the testimony of Ms. Ferris, it was brief, it was over very quickly, and Michelle was left with the impression, we believe, from all of that evidence, that email was the primary reason. I think another employee was terminated that day, Michael McKinney, and his was based on excessive personal email, and that's in his personnel file. And the two of them met afterwards and concurred with each other that, oh, yes, we just got terminated for all these emails. And I think the letterhead, yes, it's horrible, but I think in her mind 2.5 years later, she realized it was the email that was just stuck in her mind. And I think she's tried to maintain that throughout, and it's made her look as though she's not being totally honest. But I think in her defense, it's not really what happened.
From your argument, how much deference should we give to the board's credibility determination?
I think the panel should be given the greatest deference. In the Stafford case, it's argued by opposing counsel in their brief. They heard the testimony. They saw the witnesses live. They didn't recommend a permanent ban. In fact, no one in this whole process has. The interviewers did not. The Cincinnati Review Board did not. And the three-member panel did not. It was only until it got to the full board that we find the permanent ban. And that's we have some problems too with the board report we want to point out to you. It makes some factual references that I want to get clarified here on the record. On page 2, paragraph 7, the board report mentions the meeting, termination meeting, being immediately upon discovery of the email. We know from Ms. Ferris's testimony on page 146, line 20, that just isn't true. And the board puts a lot of reliance in Ms. Ferris and in these facts, and that is not a fact in the record. In fact, Ms. Ferris states that the emails were discovered at 11:30 in the morning, and the meeting to terminate and call in Michelle was later that afternoon. It was not immediate. Page 3 of the board report, paragraph 14.
Is immediate defined in this report?
I think they put some weight in the fact that it was discovered and immediately taken care of to the benefit of the employer. I think the credibility of the employer that was in the board's mind that they nipped it in the bud immediately, but that's not what
happened. 4 hours to you is not immediate. To be discovered and then terminated 4 hours later.
That's not definition immediate for me.
Okay.
Counsel, you said you thought we ought to look to the panel's advice. Is that what your client is seeking, is to be allowed to take it in July of 2014?
We, of course, would love to have her then sooner, but we would not have even filed objections if the board had upheld the panel's recommendation of July 2014. We're not thrilled with it, but we wouldn't have objected to that. At least this young woman would have gotten a chance to take the bar, and we're here today just to give her that second chance.
And that would involve going through the process of an interview again?
She'd be happy to go through that whole process again, application and all, absolutely. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my little bit of remaining time for rebuttal and closing.
Mr. Wiest.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Christopher Wiest, and along with Michael Mann, we represent both the Cincinnati Bar Association as well as the Board of Commissioners on Character and Fitness in this matter. I'd like to address two issues this morning, and I think the first leads into the second. The first is, what is the appropriate resolution of factual disputes to the extent that they exist, and what deference is to be afforded to the determinations of the panel of the Board of Commissioners on Character and Fitness? And second, the question of whether or not Mrs. McKinney should ever be permitted to reapply for the bar examination, and if so, when. Addressing the first issue, this court, and it was interesting to conduct the research in this matter, there's been no case law on the character and fitness process as there is in the disciplinary process in terms of deference to the board panel. But the rules are very, very similar in both the disciplinary cases and the character and fitness process. The only difference is disciplinary matters, it's the burden of the Bar Association or the disciplinary counsel to prove by clear and convincing evidence that misconduct has occurred. In this case, the burden is upon the applicant. In the disciplinary process, and if you look at the Wise case, it's clear that the standard that this court applies, and we believe that it is appropriate in character and fitness matters, is that unless the record weighs heavily against the hearing panel's findings, deference is to be accorded to the panel's determinations, noting that the panel heard and saw the testimony firsthand. And I think that stands for the proposition that when you have factual disputes and testimony of witnesses, and we all know that nonverbal cues and things like that go into determining those factual inconsistencies, deference is appropriately afforded to the person or people who view the witnesses live. And it's our position that as opposed to a de novo review, that deference be afforded to the panel that heard and saw the witnesses live. There is some dispute in this matter, but there's not some but there's no dispute over a couple of key facts, and I'd like to start there. There's no dispute
well,
about...
Is your bottom line that you think the panel's recommendation is what we ought to go with?
No, Your Honor. I think the ultimate recommendation of disposition is a legal question for this court or for the entire board, but the factual resolution of factual disputes, the factual findings, I think the panel's in the best position to be the fact finder.
I try to look at these character and fitnesses with the sort of the same lens as a disciplinary in terms of the disposition. And on this fact pattern, had it come to us as a disciplinary, I would never have gone permanent disbar. And so I'm wondering, why is it that, I mean, I would have given somebody of this person, of this background, assuming all the facts, worst case scenario, against the applicant. Okay, so we'll take the worst case scenario, she lied. Let's take that as the preposition. I still would have probably not gone disbar. So what would be the reason we should go disbar here versus somebody who's been practicing and came up before us in an almost identical fact pattern?
Well, Your Honor, we would respond that we believe that the case law that comes out of this court in the character and fitness process does support a finding that, and I think it's a close question in this case, does support a finding that she not be permitted to reapply. And I think if you look at a line of cases from this court, and you start with the Corrigan case, that was a case that involved somebody that was cheating on the bar exam. That was bad. But what really did the applicant in that case was the lack of honesty throughout the process, and in particular, lack of honesty under oath before the panel of board and commissioners, which is exactly what we had here. If you look at the Kaveman case, I mean, that is a case that is almost completely on point. You have misconduct at an employer during law school, and then you have equivocation and you have dishonesty during the testimony process before the board. And that, I think, is what distinguishes the cases where somebody is allowed to reapply versus the cases where this court has previously held that someone not be allowed to reapply.
So you think there should be a different standard for the application process than for the disciplinary process?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that this court's precedent seems to indicate that. I don't think that's for me to decide.
Well, counsel, we had, I think his name is Attorney Farmer, who was mixed up in a murder. Some dispute as to his involvement as a juvenile, but he ultimately was allowed to take the bar. Yes, it's a reason for concern, great concern, in terms of the board's feeling that there was a lack of candor about these past events. And as Justice Stratton said, assume the worst as to these past events. The lack of candor with the board is of great concern. But if she's allowed to reapply, she's going to have to go through the same rigorous process, perhaps not seeing the same exact lawyers that interviewed her before, but she'll still have a heightened sense of skepticism on the part of the Cincinnati folks that would be interviewing her. But you still believe not ever to have the opportunity to practice.
Your Honor, I would say this on behalf of the Bar Association and the board. I think it's a close call. And here's the issue. I think the issue comes down to we have an applicant who throughout this entire process, from the time that she filed her application, when she was giving the reasons for her dismissal, to her initial interview with Mr. Mann and myself, when the story was, well, at first, you know, there was the opportunity to come clean. That did not occur. And then the story was, well, yeah, I did this letter, but I never sent it, and I thought that I would just have the employer sign it if I needed the letter, which was obviously false. I suppose she thought that the letter no longer existed, and perhaps it might not have. We didn't know. We didn't have possession of the letter at that point in time when we did her initial interview. And then we get to the CBA panel. And Your Honor, it wasn't just Mr. Mann and myself that we were not on that review panel. We were present during that process. But you had an entire panel of Cincinnati lawyers that watched her. And then the story was, well, I don't remember anything. Mind you, she had had her personnel file at that point in time. The testimony before the panel was that her husband had reviewed the file, and it said, uh-oh, they know about the letter. And it told her that. But again, it was this claimed lack of memory. And then we get up to the board panel, and the story changes repeatedly. Well, Mr. Mann and I would never ask me. Mr. Mann and Mr. Weiss never asked me about the letter. Was at first what she said, and then her attorney kept trying to get her to, you know, say something different. And ultimately, she did. Well, they asked me a couple questions. We get her on cross. It's well, yeah, there was about a dozen questions asked about that letter. And the story continued to change in response not just to the cross-examination but to the panel's questioning. For lack of a better term, Your Honors, it was almost like a train wreck because the story just kept changing and changing and changing under oath before a panel of this court. I don't know whether or not this applicant, if given additional time, can reconcile within herself that the problem here is not just the creation of the fictitious letterhead. And by the way, we do take exception with the idea that it wasn't sent. Her testimony was she was going to send it that night. If you look at the transcript in this matter, I believe it's on page 46, she was going to send it that night. Now, she got caught hours later, and I think that's what derailed her actually sending that letter. But that letter, I mean, under her own testimony, was going out the door. And, Your Honors, putting aside the initial misconduct and the creation of the letter to get out of the legal obligation, the issue really is that there's never been any recognition by this applicant that she was dishonest in the process itself and a failure to appreciate that. And I think that's what left the board panel, in addition to perhaps the false testimony under oath, that failure to recognize that it's not just about the letter. It's about the misconduct that went on throughout the admissions
counsel,
process.
Her husband's an attorney, correct?
Your Honor, I'm not clear about that. I know that he was a law student at the time. I don't know that he's been licensed or not.
Okay. Because I was just wondering about the process of him taking a bar exam with, you know, this kind of a background.
Your Honor, I understand, and I think just in talking with the Cincinnati Bar Council that's a concern for the Bar Association as well. I don't know anything beyond that. I know that Bar Council has some concern about that issue as well. I would say this, though. I'm sure that his prospects will largely depend on how he applies and how candid he is in the process. Because, again, I think it's a different question about the underlying misconduct versus the issue of candor throughout the admissions process. I think that changes, and just to Mr. Richard's point about, well, the recommendation kept changing. It was a weight, and now it's no longer about a weight. Now it's about whether or not she can ever sit for the bar. I think the consequences have changed over time because the hole that she has dug over time and through her dishonesty has grown deeper and deeper and deeper, culminating with the dishonesty under oath before the panel of this court, for the panel of the Board of Commissioners on bar and on character and fitness. Your Honors, if there's no other questions, I will go ahead and sit down. Thank you.
Counsel, you've reserved a little over a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Richards, is Ms. McKinney's current position in jeopardy if she does not take and pass the bar exam?
No, Your Honor. She's there in a management position, supervising, and a non-lawyer type position. So, no, that she would be needed there, and her prospects for employment are good for a while. I think if at some time, though, I think she's expected to take the bar and become an attorney. So I think it's good for now. I think it could be a problem down the road for her. And that's why we didn't have a problem with a little bit of a wait. But I think to not let her sit at all, I think would be a mistake. She's shown in the last recent times a lot of honesty and integrity and growth, personal growth. And I think understanding this process now, as naive as she was back then, I think we'll see a totally different applicant this time. And I think we need to give her a chance to do that. I am here today only because I believe in Michelle McKinney. I've practiced almost 30 years, and I have three law school professors and a magistrate from Butler County that agree with me. I wouldn't be here today if I didn't believe in Michelle McKinney. I'm asking you to give her the benefit of the doubt. Yes, she's made some mistakes, but let's give her the benefit of the doubt. Let her reapply, and give her a second chance.
And those recommendations that you've gotten, they're fully aware of the entire background here.
As far as I know, I didn't get them, but she did, and I think the professors.
You know,
wrote
if the entire record was disclosed to them,
no, I do not.
Okay.
What's does this process impact her ability to take a Kentucky bar exam?
I believe it would. I don't know if she's pursued that, but I think what I know of it is she's checked into it, and they want all the details of what happens with this court. And I think likely a ban in one state is probably a lifetime ban in the other 49. I mean, I can't imagine a state that would take a recommendation that severe and allow that person to come in. So I think we're not only banning her in Ohio, we're lifetime banning her in the entire country.
So that alternative, so far as you know, is not
I don't think
undertaken
Kentucky
at this point in time.
They're not committing either way. I think they're going to wait and see what happens here before they even give her an interview.
So she's applied, though, to take the Kentucky bar.
I think she's inquired, Your Honor. I don't think she's actually applied until this was resolved. But I think she's had an inquiry with the people at the Kentucky bar, and they've advised her that she might as well just wait. There's no point in her applying yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.